Thank you for downloading Business Matters from the BBC World Service. 50 minutes of interviews and discussion on the day's big news stories and themes from Asia, America, and across the globe.
It's midnight GMT. You're listening to the BBC World Service with me, Jamie Robertson. In the Americas, the week's coming to an end. In Asia, they're well into the weekend. Here at the BBC, we'll bring the time zones and their stories together in Business Matters. We're going to be assessing the latest protests in the US against the lockdowns.
Our community is struggling. My husband is on unemployment for the first time in our life. We want to go back to work. We have bills to pay.
And we'll be in Australia, where an economy that was one of the few developed nations to avoid recession during the financial crisis now heads into a downturn. And for those millions in the US out of work, many are starting to wonder where their next meal is going to come from. We talk to the people who may be able to help them. That's all coming up on Business Matters of the BBC World Service, just after the news.
Hello, I'm Chris Barrow with the BBC News. President Trump has defended a series of tweets supporting protests against lockdown measures in several US states. At a White House briefing, he said the measures imposed by some states had been too tough. Earlier, he called for three states to be, in his words, liberated. They're led by Democrats. From Washington, Jane O'Brien reports.
Demonstrations against orders to stay at home have been gaining momentum in places with relatively few infections. And President Trump has fueled discontent with tweets urging protesters to liberate Virginia, Michigan, and Minnesota, which have Democratic governors, even as he said it was up to all governors to decide how and when to lift restrictions. The Republican governor of Texas, meanwhile, has said that he will start the process of reopening his state, despite concerns about the availability of adequate testing.
President Trump began the White House news conference with an announcement of a $19 billion financial aid package for farmers hit by the coronavirus pandemic. $16 billion has been earmarked for direct payments to farmers and ranchers in financial difficulties. The World Health Organization has cast doubt on the usefulness of antibody tests for COVID-19. WHO officials in Geneva said there was no evidence that having had the virus would guarantee immunity. Some countries have planned widespread antibody testing as a way of helping people return to work. Imogen Folks reports.
Much hope has been invested in antibody tests, but today the World Health Organization said there was no evidence so far that having had the virus guaranteed immunity. In fact, initial data suggests a relatively low percentage of people develop antibodies to the coronavirus, and therefore the idea that eventually herd immunity can be created may be unrealistic. The WHO is instead advising countries, for now, to plan a cautious transition out of lockdown.
Here in Britain, National Health Service leaders have warned that some hospitals in England will run out of key protective equipment for staff treating coronavirus patients this weekend. New guidance has been written asking doctors and nurses to work without full-length fluid-resistance gowns and to reuse equipment where necessary. Here's our health correspondent, Jane Dreeper.
The warning has come from the head of NHS providers, Chris Hobson, who represents trusts providing care across England. In a tweet, he said, "We have now reached the point where the national stock of fully fluid repellent gowns will be exhausted in the next 24 to 48 hours. BBC News reported last week that Public Health England was planning to suggest the reuse of protective gowns as a last resort, and this guidance has now been issued.
Jane Dreeper. This is the latest world news from the BBC.
Hello, welcome to Business Matters with me, Jamie Robertson. I'm going to be joined by Liz Gwynn, who's a broadcast journalist from Australia's Nine TV channel. She's going to be in Albury in New South Wales. We're having a little bit of problem getting her up on the line, but we will in just a second. I am confident of that fact. But for now, let's start in the United States. That is the sound of demonstrations, the hooting of horns in Michigan. It's part of a growing number of protests across the country demanding an end to the lockdowns, and they do appear to be getting the support of President Trump. Demonstrations are taking place in Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, Minnesota, Utah, Virginia and Kentucky, and more are planned in Wisconsin, Oregon, Idaho and Texas. Health officials warn that lifting the restrictions could spread infection. On Thursday, the US recorded a record number of deaths in a 24-hour period from coronavirus, 4,591. But protesters say the severe economic restrictions are hurting citizens.
Our community is struggling. My husband is on unemployment for the first time in our life. And it's unwillingly that we're taking unemployment. We want to go back to work. We have bills to pay.
It's time for our state to be opened up. We're tired of not being able to buy the things that we need, go to the hairdressers, get our hair done. It's time to open up.
Well, as for Mr. Trump, he wrote in a series of tweets, "Liberate Minnesota, liberate Michigan, and then liberate Virginia." Now, the attorney David Helm is representing four Michigan residents who have filed a federal lawsuit against the state governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and her executive order to shut down businesses, ban travel to private homes, and freedom to associate with one another violates constitutional rights. This is what Governor Whitmer told protesters.
"I support your right to free speech, and I respect your opinions. I just urge you, don't put yourself at risk, and don't put others at risk either. You know, when people are flying the Confederate flag and untold numbers who gassed up on the way here or grabbed a bite on the way home, we know that this rally endangered people. And sadly, it could prolong the amount of time we have to be in this posture. And we've got to all do our part for the sake of one another and for the sake of our economy."
That's Michigan State Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Now, I talked to the lawyer, David Helm. I asked him to explain his argument.
"We're arguing that the governor's executive orders have gone too far, specifically the right to associate under the First Amendment, which protects individuals' rights to protest the government, but also to be involved with their family and their friends and associate with whomever they want. We have people that have not contracted COVID-19 that are not likely to have contracted it. There's no suspicion that they've been around somebody with it, and yet they're still quarantined, basically, and house arrest. And that's our problem, is that it's just too overbroad."
Okay, forgive me, because I'm certainly no constitutional expert, but doesn't the Constitution also say that the government's there for the security, the benefit, and the protection of the people? Isn't that just what it's doing? It's trying to protect the people.
Well, the government does have a role to play, but we have fundamental freedoms protected under the Constitution. One is the right to interstate travel, traveling between states. The other one is the right to intrastate travel, traveling within the state. We have the right to associate. We have the right to be free from unreasonable governmental restrictions. And if the government is encroaching on any of those rights, then the government needs to pass what's called a strict scrutiny test. Their laws and regulations need to be so narrowly tailored to the least restrictive amount of encroach on those fundamental rights.
I mean, there's a risk, as with all law cases, that this might go on way beyond the duration of the restrictions. So you might find yourself arguing about something which is well past. Is that a problem?
It is and it isn't. We want to set a precedent where the governor of the state of Michigan is not setting a precedent that it's okay to do this. So we want to see some judicial review of this and make sure that the government is reined in the future.
How would you feel if the restrictions were lifted and the number of cases went up and the death rate went up, directly correlated to the lifting of restrictions?
Well,
it's a hypothetical question, I understand, but you know,
yeah,
there is a possibility and people argue that would happen.
Yeah, you know, and the government came out and made a statement today that the number of new infections is slowing down. And she said that that is a specific result of her stay-at-home order. And I think it's really impossible to say one way or the other. It could be simply that the people that are out are taking the precautions that the CDC has the Center for Disease Control. You know, washing your hands more thoroughly, making sure you stay away from people, wear masks, wear gloves, do those sort of things. Those might be the contributing factors to the reduction and not the stay-at-home order.
Do you think what you're saying represents the thoughts of many people? I mean, you're representing four people, and there have been a number of protests in Michigan and in other states. Are there a lot of people who think that way, do you think?
Well, based off of my Facebook comments and the phone calls our office has been receiving, as well as the emails, I would say it's about half the state at least. But we are getting calls from citizens from other states, as well as attorneys from other states that want to bring similar things against their governors in their states.
Can I just ask you, not as a lawyer, but as a citizen of Michigan and of the United States, what's the mood like there at the moment? How do people feel?
Anxious. Every day seems kind of like a Sunday evening here, where there's very little cars on the road. Everyone's kind of seems to be keeping to themselves and doing their own thing. It's quiet, but there's this undertone of anxiety.
That was the attorney, David Helm, who I was speaking to earlier. Now, we are joined by Liz Gwynn from Albury. From her home, I presume. Liz, your home to mine?
Correct, yes. Hello.
Via the BBC. Thanks very much for joining us. You heard that interview. I mean, people are obviously in the States, in a number of states in the US, very tired at the moment and very worried about just not making any money. Is that a feeling that's shared in Australia?
Absolutely. A lot of people all over the world, but particularly here as well, have lost their jobs. So there's that feeling of how can I provide for my family? There's been delays in the JobKeeper allowance. So a lot of people are really, as mentioned before, anxious and fearful at this time. I mean, the majority of Australians do seem pretty compliant, however, in terms of the restrictions. We're pretty fortunate here because we don't have the severe restrictions like in other countries. So that definitely does help. But I think for the most part, people do understand their own social responsibility and have really been doing that. And there's also been a sense of camaraderie between the state and federal governments as well. So I think that that's really helped to flatten the curve. Everyone does seem to be working together for the most part on this.
The camaraderie between the states and the central government, that's a very unusual thing, because nearly always you find a kind of tension between, well, one, a competition between states, and two, very much a tension between the central government and the states. In this case, you think they're actually getting on very well.
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say very well. Maybe that is a slight stretch, but yes, to an extent they are. I mean, we have Labor and we also have Liberal premiers, so from opposition parties, but they have all seemingly come together on this and actually agreed with the federal government in terms of some of the restrictions in place. Now, some states have more severe lockdowns than others or severe restrictions than others. For example, in Western Australia, it's shut completely off to the rest of the country because it can do that just due to distance, whereas Victoria and New South Wales, because they share a border, they've had to be very, very good in working together and being able to flatten the curve together. And especially where I'm at the moment, Albury actually borders onto, it's a border it shares with Wodonga. So some restrictions are in place in terms of fishing and hunting and that type of thing in Victoria, whereas New South Wales doesn't have the same. So even policing and that type of thing, they've had to come together to work on this.
Yeah, so you don't get that feeling of sort of anger, which there is in the United States. But and also, these are people out of work and they're losing money, and some of them feel they're not even going to get a job when it's all over. So that's the kind of, it's not just, it's an anxiety that's becoming angry, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the only real pushback that we've actually had this week was when the government revealed about a proposed contact tracing app. And that's basically to monitor coronavirus cases and where they are and any clusters of cases. So there were real concerns about privacy, and they thought that the federal government didn't have the right to invade their privacy like that. And a lot of people were standing firm saying that they didn't want it, whereas the federal government fought back and said it's necessary if we are going to ease restrictions. So there was definitely a lot of anger towards that. There has been anger, as I mentioned, about some of the allowances and I guess the delays in rolling those payments out. Some people have said that they haven't even seen a proper payment yet, or they're living off $40 a week. And, you know, some uni students, we had a case study where a uni student said that she's only seen $40 and just doesn't know how she's going to be able to survive on that. So there's definitely been anger in terms of that. And there's been murmurs, I guess, of when businesses can start reopening again. And people want to see that happen because they want to get their jobs back effectively, but not in the same way as you're having it in the UK or in America.
Liz, I do want to look at the Australian economy now and get your thoughts on it. But we've got a report first from our Australia correspondent, Phil Mercer. Now, the country's not had a recession, as you know, for almost 30 years. It escaped the worst effects of the financial crisis. But coronavirus has changed all that. The government is predicting the jobless rate is going to double by June from just over 5% to 10%. Huge stimulus and job saving packages worth 10% of GDP have been announced. Now, from Sydney, here's Phil.
I'm having fun with my sister because it's her birthday, but I'm not really having fun because it's just that I really want to see all my friends.
Much of Australia is in lockdown. Children are home from school and thousands of businesses forced to close. Legions of Australians are unemployed. In March, 1 million jobs were lost in a single week. Welfare offices have been swamped.
It's horrible, actually, to be quite honest. I mean, I'm nearly 60 and I've never been unemployed in my life, ever. This is my very first visit to a Centrelink office and I'm devastated, but I'm sure there's people in a lot worse situation than I'm in. We have four adults in our family and three of us are unemployed as of this week.
You'll get a receipt after you submit your claim telling you your claim was submitted. For more information, go to servicesaustralia.gov.au/COVID-19.
At times, the government system for claiming benefits online hasn't been able to cope with the sheer volume of those needing help. Few industries have been spared.
Property's going. The property's going. Sold to you. Congratulations. And well bought.
Real estate agents are trying to soldier on. They've resorted to online auctions because of strict social distancing regulations. But the market is in deep trouble. Matthew Hayson runs an agency in Sydney.
Our Armageddon plan is if we see, you know, a 50% reduction in our income in property management and zero sales income. We've got a huge company here. We manage 4,000 rentals. If it gets to that point, the world's ended.
Good evening. Desperate times, extraordinary measures.
Help, though, is on its way. A historic $80 billion rescue package aims to protect the jobs of 6 million Australians. That's half the workforce. It'll pay wages to staff in businesses that are in lockdown. Natasha Hawker, who's a consultant, says government support is badly needed.
It is actually a bloodbath at the moment. We're seeing businesses panicking, they're making rash decisions as they desperately scramble to save their businesses.
COVID-19 is causing an economic calamity in Australia. The signs of distress are everywhere. Here in the centre of Sydney, the roads are quiet, most of the shops are shut, as are the cafes and bars. There's hardly anyone around. Australia is usually such an optimistic place, but in so many ways you can feel its confidence ebbing away. Jennifer Westacott, the head of the Business Council of Australia, says restoring the country's self-belief will help the economy to recover.
One of the really crucial things is give people a sense of confidence. We started in a stronger position, we had a stronger set of economics, a strong set of banks. We've really got to paint a picture of hope for people, because I think the biggest ingredient that's missing at the moment is hope.
The last recession in Australia was in the early 1990s. COVID-19 is almost certain to bring that proud economic record to an end. Some sectors, including supermarkets and delivery services, will flourish during the pandemic. But many businesses are facing the fight of their lives to survive.
That was Phil Mercer there in Sydney. Liz, I mean, all that must be incredibly familiar to you. Any particular industries, businesses that sort of stand out for you in your experience as a reporter there in New South Wales?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of businesses have had to really adapt and to transition away from what they would usually do, such as restaurants. Instead of having people dining in, they're now moving towards takeaway. But what's been really amazing, I was in Perth recently for work, just the amount of businesses who have managed to re-employ people just by doing things a little bit differently. So, for example, back in the day, we used to have our milk delivered to our doorstep. So that's been something that has been continued by one of the milk manufacturers over in Perth in Western Australia. And another one is in terms of a doorstop grocer. So instead of having to go to the supermarket, which many people don't want to do, they've managed to bring big boxes of fruit and vegetables, the freshest produce from farmers around the local areas, right to your doorstep. So they've been able to, just through public support and awareness of this, they've been able to actually re-employ people, which has been really positive in light of this. And what's been quite amazing is those people who do have jobs and who can afford to spend a little bit more money have actually opted to help these smaller businesses as opposed to the giant supermarkets.
But for some industries there, I mean, this is coming back on the back of other disasters. I mean, there was the bushfires down. Were they close to you or further south or east from where you are exactly? But I mean, that's the sort of thing which, and also then you had floods as well on top of that. So you've not had a good year, have you?
Yeah, 2020 has been a terrible year for us, as you mentioned, and we were very close to the bushfires. So half an hour away, we had bushfires burning. And one industry that's been hit really hard has been the wine industry. So Rutherglen is quite a well-known wine industry, and a lot of the grapes were unusable because of the smoke tank that they had from the bushfires. So they had to effectively get rid of or succumb to the fact that they wouldn't have a vintage for 2020, and they were relying on people coming through the cellar door, but of course now that can't happen. So they believe that the wine industry, a third of wineries may have to close as a result of this. But yes, as you mentioned, many farmers and other people impacted by bushfires, and now a lot of local businesses impacted by this.
I want to get away from coronavirus. One of the few times which one can, because we had a story here breaking today. Accountancy firm EY, it's just been ordered to pay $10.8 million in damages to a whistleblower who claimed it covered up evidence of money laundering. Auditor Amjad Rehan sued EY after being forced out of his job in 2014. And a year earlier, Mr. Rehan led an audit that discovered Dubai's biggest gold refiner, Kaloti, had paid out a total of $5.2 billion in cash in 2012. Here's the BBC's Andy Verity, who reported on the case for the BBC's Panorama, which is still available on the BBC's iPlayer.
We had a documentary which went out in October, which you can still find on BBC's iPlayer, actually, called Following the Drug Money. And after months of investigation, we revealed that EY, one of the world's four biggest accountancy firms, covered up evidence of smuggling by an organised crime gang that was laundering drug money from the sale of illegal drugs all over Europe. And we found out that EY failed to report suspicious activity at one of the world's largest gold refineries, that's Kaloti, based in Dubai, and then altered a compliance report to hide the crime. Both EY and Kaloti denied any wrongdoing, but now a judge has found EY breached its professional code of ethics and engaged in professional misconduct. Back in 2013, Amjad Rehan was an EY partner in charge of checking that gold purchased by gold refineries in Dubai didn't come from dodgy sources, such as conflict zones in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And his team, auditing one of Dubai's biggest refiners, Kaloti, came across suspicious activity, including billions of pounds in cash that it handed over in exchange for scrap gold, and 3.5 tons of gold that had been painted silver to evade Moroccan export controls. Now, Amjad Rehan urged his bosses to issue a zero-tolerance finding about Kaloti, but instead, EY encouraged Kaloti to alter a compliance report removing references to gold, painted silver and Morocco, and instead calling it documentary irregularities. And after he refused to sign the altered reports, he fell out with bosses at EY and he was forced out. Now, after leaving EY, Mr. Rehan went public in 2014 to expose his suspicions, but EY refused to admit any wrongdoing. Then, in 2017, 27 members of a Moroccan gang were convicted in France for laundering drug money collected from the sale of hash and other illegal drugs all over Europe. They'd laundered the money by buying and selling black market gold, including to refiners in Dubai. And we discovered that the very same gold-painted silver that Amjad Rehan's team came across in 2013 came from a company called Renaid International, whose beneficial owner was a leading member of the convicted drug gang. Now, after months in court, a judge came down emphatically in Mr. Rehan's favour, finding EY colluded with Dubai regulators to conceal Mr. Rehan's team's damaging findings and awarded $10.8 million of damages. Mr. Rehan gave us his reaction this afternoon.
I really hope that EY would use this judgment as an opportunity to improve, to avoid such events happening again in the future. For me personally, it's been almost 7 years of agony for me and my family, and we've been fighting for justice, and I'm so relieved and so happy to get a taste of justice.
That was the auditor Amjad Rehan finishing that report from Andy Verity. Now, Kaloti have denied accepting gold-painted silver. They also deny any wrongdoing. We approached EY for a statement and they said it is surprised and disappointed by the judge's decision and will appeal the ruling. In a statement, EY said it was the work of an EY Dubai assurance team that uncovered serious irregularities and reported them to the proper authorities. We'll be back in just a few moments. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Jamie Robertson, and my guest, the broadcaster, Liz Gwynn, who's in Australia, in Albury in New South Wales. Now, in the first half of the programme, we talked about the economic costs of the virus and the lockdowns. Economists have been agonising over this for several months and have come out with some, well, fairly gloomy forecasts. Now, the head of the International Monetary Fund says recent predictions of huge declines and widespread recessions may be, wait for it, understatements. She's Kristalina Georgieva, and she's been talking to our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Let me compare to where we were 3 months ago, before we had to retreat from our offices and from schools because of COVID-19. At that time, we projected 160 countries to have positive income per capita growth. In other words, to get better off. Now we are projecting 170 countries to see income per capita shrinking during 2020. A global recession we have not seen during our lifetimes. I want to stress this may be actually a more optimistic picture than reality produces. Epidemiologists are now helping us making macroeconomic projections. Never in the history of the IMF we had that. And what they are telling us is that the novel coronavirus is a big unknown. We don't know whether it may return in 2021.
It's the IMF that traditionally worries about too much government borrowing. Are you saying that this is a time where finance ministers should not be worried about those things?
Governments should spend as much as then they can afford and more. But keep the receipts. We don't want to lose accountability and transparency during this crisis. We can help countries in these days of very low interest rates to get more ammunition to fight the health crisis, pay doctors, nurses, keep hospitals working, but also to fight the economic crisis.
Lots of people say that there's pressure for an exit strategy. They're agitating for an exit strategy.
What I would say is that we have some examples now where containment measures have produced the necessary results and reopening has started. If you look at China, this is what is happening there. And we have to then carefully calibrate how we're doing this reopening.
How important is it that this is dealt with in the world's poorest countries?
The poor countries in the world are hit multiple times. They're hit by the pandemic. They're hit by the spillover from economic contraction elsewhere. The G20 has taken a decision on debt standstill, which would free billions of dollars for the poorest countries.
That was Kristalina Georgieva, who is the head of the IMF, talking to our economics editor, Faisal Islam. My colleague, Fergus Nicol, decided to explore the idea of debt standstill or debt cancellation, prompted by an email from a listener.
On the satellite radio this morning, your story was talking about all the governments having to go into debt to help people survive this pandemic. What would happen to the world's economy if all the countries just agreed that on a certain day, all debt is erased? And then, when we're back to normal, everyone could just start over from zero. Or if not 100% debt forgiveness, how about 50%?
Very thought-provoking comments, thanks to Christine. The conversation she heard was with our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker, and I'm delighted to say Andrew's back with us now. Let's hold that kind of bombshell question to the end, but let's talk us through the various stages of possible debt relief leading up to that potential for massive cancellation. Remind us of what the G7 and then the G20 agreed to.
They agreed to defer any payments that were owed to the governments of the G20 by 77 of the world's poorest countries, any payments that were due between May this year and the end of 2020, with the possibility of extending that if a review later on in the year suggested that that was desirable. Now, I'd emphasise this is a question of deferment, not cancellation of those payments. So the countries that would benefit from it would benefit on a kind of interim basis. Money that would have been used to make debt payments will now be available for dealing with the health and economic consequences of the coronavirus, but those debt repayments will be kind of rolled up and will have to be made up at some stage in the future.
Let's explore this range of ideas that are advocated by some of the debt relief campaign groups. And we're going to start with Sarah Jane Clifton, who is director of the Jubilee Debt Campaign.
To start with, we're asking for the cancellation of the 2020 debt payments for the poorest countries. And then we're asking for a process, ideally a UN-led process, to look at the overall debt levels of those countries and to cancel or restructure those debts down to a level that the countries can actually afford to pay so that they can continue to perform basic government functions like providing healthcare, providing education, social protection, these kinds of things, and particularly in the context of coronavirus when there's enormous pressure on developing country budgets and finances because of the health needs.
Some argue that, and I've heard this for nearly 30 years now from the IMF and the World Bank and so on, that if you let developing countries off debt repayments, they'll just overspend because they know they'll get more in the future. Is that valid? If so, how do you stop it happening?
I think the biggest moral hazard in the system at the moment is the fact that reckless lenders keep being bailed out. So there's a lot of very good reasons which we want to see changed why developing countries are so reliant on debt at the moment. And that's not to do with irresponsible spending. It's to do with big outflows of capital because of tax dodging, because of unfair trade rules, the fact that their economies are locked in low-value production, low-value manufacturing and raw material extraction. That's the reasons why developing countries are having to keep borrowing. A lot of money flooded out of the richer countries post-2008 and was chasing yield, investing in quite high-risk developing country debt. And there's a moral hazard in the system because the IMF and World Bank, rather than when a country is close to debt crisis, pushing for a restructuring of those debts, the IMF and World Bank lend money to those countries to help them get out of the crisis, which is effectively paying off the reckless lenders.
That's Sarah Jane Clifton. Our thanks to her. She's director of Jubilee Debt Campaign. Andrew's still with us. Her first point then, moving from postponing short-term debt repayments in 2020 to cancelling them. That's an upgrade, so to speak.
Yes, and it's certainly one that an awful lot of campaigners would like to see, and it would alleviate those countries of the issue that I mentioned earlier on, which is that although they might have some resources freed in the short term, they'd have to make up for that later on by with higher debt payments in the future than they were previously planning. This idea of cancelling some of the debt payments is something that has actually been agreed for the International Monetary Fund. It has agreed that a period
of 6 months, debts owed by 25 of the poorest countries, so that's a smaller group, will not have to be repaid. The IMF has got another fund that it has built up with donations, mainly from rich country governments, which is going to be used to make those payments. And it does mean, for that relatively short window at least, a rather smaller group of countries are going to be completely relieved of those payment obligations.
Right, and that's moving a lot closer to what Christine was talking about, Andrew, in her question, total debt cancellation. Some people call it debt forgiveness. Radical approach, one supported by groups like the European Network on Debt and Development. They're based in Brussels. It's a coalition of 50 activist organisations across 20 nations in Europe. Their policy and advocacy manager for debt justice is Mark Pereira.
Partial debt cancellation will only mean that freed up resources will potentially be used to pay back other creditors. The G20, by agreeing only to postpone payments, is really storing up debt crisis risks for later. And the way the agreement is set up, this effectively costs creditors nothing, and borrowing countries will simply have bigger repayments to make down the line at a moment when they may find it very difficult to refinance and might need to take on new loans just to make these repayments. So we really see permanent cancellation of debts as necessary to enable developing countries to deal with the enduring impacts of the pandemic.
Well, thanks to Mark Pereira, speaking from Brussels at Eurodad. Last word then on this with Andrew. And let's go back to Christine's email. And this is the big picture. It's more than just the developing world. Christine is asking about everybody, all debt. What would we see?
It's a very big vision, isn't it? I mean, in terms of the poorest countries, I suppose in principle it is possible with the right decisions taken by some of the rich countries to simply cancel all their debt. But a kind of what she seems to be suggesting is some sort of worldwide debt cancellation followed by starting all from scratch. That would create some significant problems, I think, because bear in mind we're not just talking about a few hedge funds or governments of the rich countries that are having to deal with a fairly small part of their budgets. If you're talking about governments of the rich countries wiping out their own debts, then you're looking at losses made by banks, by ordinary savers. Many people would see that their own banks would then need to be financially rebuilt from start. So that's a much more challenging scenario that Christine was suggesting, I think.
It's Andrew Walker there, finishing that report by Fergus Nicol. Liz, the idea of debt forgiveness, very attractive for anybody who's in debt, of course. I mean, it is another form of stimulus. It's another way of getting the economy going again because you're stopping people's debts, of course, and effectively putting money in their pockets.
I mean, it would be wonderful, but I just don't know how realistic it is. I mean, I do think that, as mentioned before, short-term standstill is realistic and the suspension of interest as well. But in terms of forgiving complete debt, that's definitely going to be a lot harder. It sounds like it could have repercussions for banks and other creditors. But I think that definitely for a lot of Australians, it's been tough times. Some have had to been forced to dip into their super, which, as you know, could have repercussions later on in life. But I definitely think that suspension of interest rates and helping out people as it stands now is good. But the complete forgiving of debt, as much as it's attractive, I don't think it's possible.
There are sort of other aspects of debt which could be looked at. And some people have suggested things like student debt. Is that an issue in Australia? I know it's becoming a big political football in the United States.
Yes, absolutely. There's been a lot of talk about student debt here and what the government can do because the younger generation is really expected to be hit the hardest in all of this. And experts are saying it could take us decades to get back. And also for the younger generation, all of this and in terms of having to get back into the black could lead to higher taxes for young people, reduced public services, higher land tax and the like. So it's definitely one of those things that should be looked at more in terms of student debt, just to help that younger generation in terms of buying a house and the like, just help them get more of a front foot with all of this.
The whole question of moral hazard, though, if you lend somebody money then don't ask for it back, then of course you the idea is that you encourage them to be more feckless, as it were, with their with future loans and things like that. That of course, I suppose, is the problem in debt forgiveness as opposed to actually giving people money. I mean, there's something sort of morally a bit more attractive about sort of handing money out to somebody who needs a job, as in the way that Australia, the UK, US, and a lot of other economies are actually handing money out to people. How are they doing it in Australia? They're pushing money out through through companies to employees, aren't they?
Yes, they are. So they've got the JobKeeper payment at the moment, which effectively supports businesses who have been impacted by COVID-19. So what it really does is it helps with the cost of their employees' wages, so that once all of this is over, Australians can actually retain their jobs because that's what they're really concerned about. So effectively, it's all varying levels of being eligible, but fortnightly payments of about $1,500. So for many people, this is definitely helping them and securing their position once all of this is over, as I mentioned, which is good.
It is working, is it? It's actually getting through the money.
Yes, at the moment it does seem to be working. It's been positive from what I've been hearing on the ground to the people I've been speaking to. It has been quite positive, and it's kept businesses afloat that perhaps otherwise wouldn't be able to, and also kept people in jobs, or at least knowing that they will have a job once all of this is over as well. So whilst they might not be working currently, they know their position is going to be there in the future, which gives them a little bit of security in such uncertain times.
Now, I want to talk a bit more about keeping people afloat in a different sense, because in the US, this is before the advent of the coronavirus, the government there, the US government, estimated that more than 37 million people struggle with hunger. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has directly or indirectly put millions out of work and onto the breadline. The Feeding America Network is the largest hunger relief organization in the United States, and it's launched the COVID-19 Response Fund. But it's short of funds, it's short of food and volunteers, as Kai Risdale from our sister program Marketplace found out.
So I had a conversation this week with Claire Babineau-Fontenot. She's the CEO of a nonprofit in this country called Feeding America. They run a network of food banks to distribute to those people most in need. And it's obviously a physically difficult thing to get all that food out into the economy, but it's also a mentally stressful thing for these workers doing this incredibly vital volunteer work. Anyway, here she is. Her name is Claire Babineau-Fontenot. She is the CEO of Feeding America.
When we last spoke, we were serving about 40 million people. We're expecting an increase because of COVID-19 of 17 million people over the course of the next 6 months that we'll have to serve. I mean, it's really unprecedented.
Yeah. How are you, to use the business phrase here, how are you resourcing that, right? Because you need donations both of food, you need to source your food, and you need to source money too.
The challenge is that the gap is so big that we haven't filled it yet. So we certainly need funds, we need food, and we need volunteers. And I have a lot of confidence in the infrastructure that we have. We're really built to serve in moments of crisis like this, but we absolutely do need help.
It's tricky, though, getting volunteers now, right? When we're all supposed to be at home.
It is. And the vast majority of our 2 million volunteers in normal times are over 70 years old. So we would not want them to sacrifice their health and safety in order to do this work right now. That's had an additional headwind for us. But we've had the National Guard come in and help, and the gap is so big, we haven't closed it completely, but we are making some progress.
Is this crisis changing how you do what you do, or are you just doing it more and faster and in larger quantities, if that makes any sense?
It's a mix of both. So we're leaning heavily on the things that we knew how to do so well, but we're absolutely having to change some things in terms of when your audience sees on television or in person witnesses some of these long, long lines of cars that are queued up. They generally are going to a mass distribution where members of our team are loading their cars with food in their trunks so that we can practice social separation. So there definitely have been some significant changes in the interest of the health and safety of the people who are in our organization, but also the public who's coming to us when they need us so much.
If this goes another 2 months of the current state of quarantine and then, you know, rolling waves of it as we try to get back on our feet, you going to be able to hang in there?
We're going to do everything we can to hang in there. But I can tell you that if we don't get significant assistance, which includes federal assistance, which we're hoping is coming really soon and will kick in over the course of the next, let's say, 4 weeks or so, the situation could become truly critical. And even beyond this crisis, if the past recession is any indication, there are going to be people who are going to be turning up to us for help for years to come. With the last recession, we just got to pre-recession rates of food insecurity in 2019 for the 2009 recession.
That report there from Kai Risdale from our sister program, Marketplace. I think the thing that I found most striking about this is actually the fact that even before this pandemic, there were so many millions of Americans who had a problem with hunger, and it's just getting worse.
Yeah, it's extremely sad. We've had a similar issue here in Australia with the ongoing drought. As you know, it was one of the worst droughts we'd seen on record, and also then the bushfires. We saw a huge spike in the number of people seeking help and different people as well. So people who, you know, farming families, for example, who usually just wouldn't want to ask for help and wouldn't want food or relying on food banks were then coming to their doors because they were in such dire need of this. So now the demand on food banks here is bigger than before with COVID-19. But on top of that, they're actually losing volunteers because people are just so worried about their own health and being on the front line, so to speak. They're not wanting to leave their homes to actually help. So they're losing volunteers. They're losing non-perishable items from supermarkets because people are stockpiling. And then the closure of op shops as well has impacted. So it's quite tough times for them to even help those in need at the moment.
So what's happening with the victims from the bushfires, from those families who were sort of who lost their homes? I mean, what's happening to them now when you get this pandemic on top of that?
Well, they're finding it really tough at the moment. I have been working with and speaking to a lot of residents in Kajiwal, which is a town close by, which was effectively wiped out. A lot of places on the outskirts were wiped out, homes, but also livestock. And they're feeling a bit forgotten at the moment because they're trying to rebuild. But as you can imagine, they're not able to source certain materials. They're not able to get out or get the workers and the trades that they needed to come and help them build fences, but also start rebuilding their homes as well. So they're really struggling at the moment to even start building their lives again because they're just not able to access the workers they once were.
I mean, where are they living? I mean, the concept of self-isolation sounds a bit ridiculous in a situation like one you've described.
Yeah, a lot of them have temporary accommodation, but some people are living in tents on their own farming properties. So there's a bit of a mixture about how they're doing it and where they're living at the moment. But it's definitely not ideal, as you said, with the restrictions and self-isolating at home.
And what about sort of income and things like that? I mean, how do they get money to survive if they've been on farms or whatever it is and they can't have any income?
Well, some people, so one lady I spoke to, she's still working. Her husband is a farmer, but she's still working and she's getting some source of an income from that. But effectively, the government has given quite a lot of packages and help in that regards to some of these farmers as they do rebuild. But, I mean, definitely their income is way down on what it usually would be at this time.
Okay. Let's turn to something a little bit more cheerful. I mean, people who are in self-isolation, who are sort of in a slightly more privileged situation and have found different ways of entertaining themselves. And we've seen here in the UK the return to some fairly traditional forms of amusement, away from screens, that is, in the form of board games and puzzles. Now, in the UK, sales figures actually trebled within a week of the start of a lockdown. And I gather in Australia, you've had a similar situation, haven't you?
Oh, we have. We've seen puzzles just flying off the shelf. It's actually quite hard to get certain puzzles that you want. And I don't know about you, Jamie, but I definitely love my games, not so much puzzles. But we've had, yeah, massive, massive attraction and appeal to this. And it's been quite amazing about even wait lists and stuff like that at stores across Albury at the moment, just because people aren't able to get the puzzles that they want. But what's quite fascinating about this is one historical society, so the Wodonga Historical Society, they've really reinvented themselves. They've turned from the traditional, perhaps, method of trying to attract people to their group and get followers, particularly of the younger generation, and they're putting their puzzles online. So what they've got is they've captured photos of either a historic homestead or perhaps a street, for example, and then what they've been able to do is make that into a puzzle and just engage such a broad range of people with that, and particularly people that haven't been able to actually find a puzzle in the shops at the moment.
I thought it's just another element of history that I can put out in front of people, and it's caught on. Not only are they doing the puzzles, but they're discussing the final picture, what they're seeing there, and as far as the page likes and the followers, far outnumbers many of the other historical societies around the place.
So that's Jutta Edmondson speaking there. And as you heard, Jamie, she's been able to engage such a broad range of people through this. And she said that this has really kept the Wodonga Historical Society valid and it's thriving because of this, which is great.
So, Liz, tell me, what do you do when you're in downtime, when you're not reporting? Do you do puzzles?
Well, I don't particularly do puzzles, but I do love board games, and I've been playing a couple of board games. So last night I played board games with a few friends on Zoom. So I've been doing it that way, where I've been able to
Do you have a physical board game, or is it actually one on a screen?
It's one on a screen. So, for example, Cards of Humanity is one of them. There's Monopoly. There's different types of ones that you can play, and you have everyone there on Zoom, so you're able to speak to them and engage, and also see their reactions as well whilst you're playing this board game, which is quite amazing. Technology is a wonderful thing in these times.
Yeah, but the puzzles though, you haven't got into those. The great thing about a puzzle is you can do it on your own as well as have friends do it as well, would you?
Well, that's true. I've never been a big puzzle person. I'm not sure why. I mean, I love reading books and I do love board games, as I said, but I've also been getting really into cooking. So what I might spend 30 minutes on usually, I now spend 2 hours on. So I've really been getting into baking and making very nice meals. So
could be the opportunity to get into puzzles as well now. Well, the opportunity to do a lot of things, I have to say. Liz, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Business Matters. It's been great to talk to you and fascinating to get insight about life in Australia and the economy there as well and what people have been going through, particularly in your area. So thanks very much indeed for joining us.